Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Episode 62 of the Intercooler podcast. Welcome back, everybody. Today, we're talking about Japanese performance car culture because there's just so much cool stuff to talk about. But before we do, we need to give you the Intercooler app update. Andrew, today, as we're recording this on the 1st of June, we published our Rimac Nevera first drive. Ben Oliver's been to Croatia to drive it. It's quite an interesting car, isn't it? 1,900 horsepower, all-electric hypercar. This was the Concept 2. They've now called it... Are we going with Nevera?
What's the alternative? Nevera?
Nevera? Nevera?
Nevera?
Nevera. But, I mean, all I wanted to say was it's bold calling it something with never in the name. Should there be production delays, it's just going to be called the Rimac Never, isn't it? let's hope that doesn't turn out to be the case.
Yeah, but I mean, it's kind of the first of the... Okay, this was actually a pre-prod unit. So if you look at this on the Instagram site, that's why it's a feature rather than a drive, because we don't mind doing pre-production units as drives as long as they are completely representative of what a customer's going to buy. And this one wasn't quite. It was like... It's nearly there, but it's not quite there. So when Dan or I drives a completely finished car, we'll do that as a formal drive. But it's the first of those, certainly that we featured, near 2,000 horsepower electric hypercars to feature. And, it is a whole new breed of car. And, I think what it's going to do is I think it's going to attract a massive spectrum of opinion. There will be those who say this is simply unbelievable, this moves the game so far beyond anything any petrol car could ever imagine achieving, and there will be those who are going, hang on, you can't fast and fun are not the same thing. It weighs whatever it weighs, a couple of tons, and it's a dead end. This is not the way to do that kind of car. So have a look at Ben's piece. Neither Dan nor I have driven it. It's a very, very interesting, obviously beautifully written assessment of the car. Go take a look.
It occurs to me that an electric hypercar is one thing, because if you're spending 2 million quid on a car, you've got other cars. Maybe you do a bit of racing or whatever. It's part of a collection, isn't it? And I can well imagine waking up one day and going, I'm going to take the electric one, just because sometimes you would.
And it's a very short journey.
I think it's a quite different matter when we're talking about an electric Lotus or an electric Boxster or A110 or something, because that's very probably someone's only car, and it might be the only car they ever have access to.
Yes.
And so to sort of gladly forego a combustion engine and a manual gearbox... those cars are going to have to be really special, aren't they?
They are, and the problem also with those cars, exactly with the Alpines and the Lotus and that sort of thing, they can't not be light. So But that is where, you know, it's fine if you've got, you know, a Rimac or a Pininfarina or a Lotus, you know, because as you say, they're going to be part of a collection. They're certainly not going to be anybody's, you know, daily driver or anything. So you can be very selective about how they, about how you use them. But if it's going to be, you know, something like, you know, a Lotus Elise, you know, that's going to be a car you're going to want to have to do distances in. Well, to do a distance, you need a big battery. So they are betting the farm on the recharging network, aren't they? Because if that's not there, then how are you going to use these cars?
And if you talk to the likes of Rimac and Pininfarina, they say that they're adamant that the big battery route is the correct one for now, because people want the range, they want the usability, the charge infrastructure really isn't there yet. And so even though their cars are heavy, they're adamant that they've chosen the right route. It's interesting, isn't it? Even within the sort of electric car world, there's a VHS Betamax thing going on.
There
with
is.
Big battery, small battery.
And then look at it the other way around. Let us suppose the charging infrastructure does turn up, and it turns up very quickly, and everybody else is, instead of doing two-ton cars, they're able to do, I don't know, 1,400 kilo cars. What are these two-ton things going to look like? They're just going to look like dinosaurs, aren't they? They're just going to look like these huge, enormous monstrosities that, you know, once roamed the world, when the world was a rather different place to the one that it is now.
Mm, interesting.
Don't know. I mean, I do have so much sympathy because, I mean, the truth is nobody knows. Nobody knows what's going to be available and when and how much it's going to cost and how well it's going to work. And so all these guys, they can say, well, you know, we know it's going to be like this. Nobody knows. Everybody is taking a punt. And there'll be some people who go there, some people who go there, and some people go, I'm going to go in the middle. And who knows who's going to be right? I take the view that actually I think you have to trust in the infrastructure, because fundamentally you have to focus on the product. And, you know, a light car is a better car from a driving point of view. And I think you just have to back the ability to get the charging infrastructure in place, because ultimately, if you don't do that, what you're looking at is a fundamental. You're always pre-engineering a fundamental flaw into your car in that it will just be heavy. Which, for the sorts of cars that we're talking about, is absolutely what you don't want them to do, particularly because you haven't got anything else, because you haven't got a gearbox and you haven't got an internal combustion engine and yada, yada, yada.
Mm. This one's going to ramble on and on, isn't it?
It is.
We'll see how it plays out. Okay, so, yeah, that review of the Rimac is now on the app. There's a shorter version, much, much shorter version, on the Instagram site. If you want the full thing, just go and check out the app. If you haven't downloaded it, do. You can download it for free, start your subscription for free. You get a free 1 month trial. It's very easy to cancel if you don't want to carry on. Just give us a go. We think that lots and lots of you have downloaded the app. We can see the data. Many of you have subscribed as well. So to all of you, thank you so much. It's been a really encouraging first month and a bit. And we've got some big, big improvements coming and lots more great stuff. So thank you for joining us. And if you haven't already, why not do so now?
I made this point on Twitter before. It's a pint of beer. And if you don't like the taste, you can send it back immediately. And they'll give you money. I mean, it's a pint of beer a month. And, you know, obviously we think it's worth it. But, you know, if you go and look at, we went through 500 ratings and reviews on the Apple and Google source over the weekend. And we are rating 5.0 on both. And you can't do better than that. This sounds terribly big-headed, doesn't it? But I'm just but the thing is, we haven't got the resources to go and, you know, buy an audience. And so really, and also we just think it's better that we talk to you guys about this and we tell you how things are, rather than trying to sort of dress it up some other way. And we just hope, I guess, that you just think it's worth having a look at, because there is literally no downside. If you don't like it, just go into the settings on your telephone and get rid of it. It's that simple. And if you do, then, you know, maybe you'll come and join us. Anyway, enough of the heavy sell. We just hope you like it.
Yeah, well, exactly what he said. Okay, but this week we are actually talking about Japanese performance cars. And I've been wondering, in preparation for this over the weekend, is there an essential nature or an essential character to a typical Japanese performance car? And I started thinking that, well, yes, there is. They very often have high revving engines. They're relatively light, modest power, quite live wire handling. And that's true to an extent. But then there are so many contradictions to that. You think about GTRs, you think about Supras, Evos and Imprezas. And then I realized that actually, when you look at it closely, there's so much variety in Japanese performance cars.
But I think there is a common thread.
And I think you're right, there is. But go on, let's hear what you think it is.
Okay, I just think it is dedication to engineering, to proper stuff. You know, all those cars, you know, if you look at, you know, a Nissan GTR, which to be honest is not particularly my kind of car, or I don't know, you know, a Honda S800 from the 1960s with, you know, a twin cam engine, you know, 800cc twin cam engine which revved to 8,500 revs in the 1960s. I mean, what do those cars have in common? I mean, you look at them on paper, they couldn't be more different. But in fact, they are both just amazingly engineered things. They're both just trying to do stuff that's really, really difficult to do because they can. And I think more than anything else, when I think of almost all good Japanese performance, sporting, fun, interesting cars, I just think of the passion that's behind them. I just think, you know, that nation is, they are as crazy about cars as anybody. You know, every bit as nuts as us, or the Italians. And they just love to demonstrate it. And they demonstrate it through these exquisitely engineered machines. And it doesn't really matter whether you're talking about, I don't know, a Civic Type R or, you know, an original Honda NSX. You know, they're just beautifully done things, aren't they?
You're right. It's that focus on the quality of the engineering, attention to detail, but also unusual engineering. And there are just so many examples. One is the R35 Nissan GTR, as you've mentioned, front-engined, transaxle, four-wheel drive. So it has to send the power backwards to the gearbox to send it forwards again to the front axle. And it's just, you know, that sort of solution. It's so sort of quintessentially Japanese. I love it. It's just, it's so interesting. So much interesting engineering going on.
I mean, if you're, you know, old like me, the fascinating thing is that when I was young, I mean, Japanese cars were just things that you laughed at. You know, this was back in the day when, you know, Nissan was called Datsun. And if you looked in the back of car magazine, in the infamous Good, the Bad, the Ugly sort of review section, and there would just be, you know, under boring saloons or boring coupes and sports cars, which is how they used to categorise it, you could just read the most trenchant criticism. Maybe it was some comments which are just plain rude. And we just used to laugh at, you know, Datsuns and Toyotas and all this, what we considered to be absolute rubbish, because they were just cheap, they fell to bits, and they were terrible to drive. But I think, I guess, certainly in my lifetime and my sort of car consciousness, even then there was a sense that, well, they could do it if they wanted to, because there was a thing called the Datsun 240Z. And the 240Z was the first of the Z cars, and we know, and there have been various Z cars, both good and bad, ever since. And amidst all this rubbish that they were knocking out, came this car which was beautiful. It had a straight six engine with three carburettors stuck on the side. It was light, and it was fantastic. People just loved them. They were very successful racing cars. And that just kind of made all us thinking, okay, so they can do it. So what's it going to be like when they actually choose to do it, when they all start to do it? And I think that they all started to really, really get going and start producing some amazing things about, what would it be, 30 years ago, a bit more. So, yeah, the MX-5. Can we just talk about the MX-5 for a bit?
Absolutely. You know, I did
the first MX-5. Road test in the UK. That was the Autocars road test on the car, and I could just remember thinking, oh shit, it's all over. This is the best thing of its kind there has ever been. It's kind of a Lotus Elan without any of the drawbacks. It was a car which was, I mean, it was close to flawless, really. When that thing first turned up, I mean, I can remember driving it. It had a beautiful little twin cam engine, rear drive, the gearbox. Whack, whack, whack. I mean, just, you know, and the gear. And you knew it could only have been created by people who got cars in the same way the rest of us got cars. Totally passionate. Because you can't synthesize that. You can't just think, you know, if you're not really, really into it, you just make a different kind of car because you wouldn't understand. And goodness, they understood. And the balance of the car and the look of the car. I mean, obviously, it was, you know, somewhat, you know, inspired by the original Lotus Elan. But yeah, there was all that. And, you know, it actually worked because, you know, you could literally, you know, if you wanted to put the hood, the roof down, you'd go flick, flick, chuck it over your head, roof down. You know, to put it back up again, reach over your shoulder, put it back up and clack. And, you know, and it rode perfectly well. It was quiet enough. You could use one as a daily driver. They were fantastically well built. That's why there are so many of them still knocking about today. And like, I just remember thinking, well, that's it. You know, if they can do this, there's nothing that they can't do. And then they started doing other stuff. So, you know, another Z car came along, the 300SX, at about that same sort of time, which was terrifyingly close to being as good as what kind of Porsche would have been around at the time, a 968, I guess, or maybe just late 944. And then came the NSX. And that was kind of like, you know, the NSX turned up. On top of everything else, the non-sporting stuff, like, you know, they did an amazing Nissan Micra at the time. Then the Lexus turned up, the LS400. Okay, it's not a sporting car, but again, that just totally reset the rules. And we thought, oh my goodness. And Toyota were really clever, because when the LS400 turned up, they said, this is our practice car. Okay? Because we'd never done a car like this before, so this is us just kind of, you know, finding our feet, toe in the water. And it was quieter than an S-Class, it was more comfortable than an S-Class. And we're just sitting there thinking, well, the European car industry was, you know, which had just ruled the roost since the dawn of time, was just sitting there thinking, oh shit. Of course, it didn't turn out to be their practice car. In many ways, it's, you know, it's arguably, when that LS400 was new, it was the best car of its type that had ever been made, and I don't think the Lexus made a better one since. But then the NSX. The NSX! I mean, when you drive a Ferrari today and you think this is absolutely amazing, part of the reason for that is the NSX. If you think about what Ferrari had at the time that the NSX came out, they had the Mondial, they had the Testarossa, and they had the 348. Unquestionably, the most rubbish lineup of cars Ferrari has ever had in its entire history.
Just as an aside, and I don't want to break your flow. No, I don't want to break your flow at all. This is good stuff. But what's a Mondial like to drive?
Actually, I quite like Mondials. Not very quick. But because they had a longer wheelbase, you know, those, the two-seaters, the thing that people just don't say these days is that, you know, 308s and 328s and 348s in particular were really tricky cars. Really difficult to drive on the limit. And a Mondial wasn't, but it was a bit softer and it had a longer wheelbase, so you could, you know, and I do quite like a Mondial. You've got to get the right one. So you've got to get the one in the middle, because the early ones are the 3 litre cars are just can't get out of their own way. They're so slow. And the 3.4 litre cars had the horrible transverse gearbox in it, which didn't work. So you've got to get a 3.2. But a 3.2 Mondas, good value today.
Good. Okay. Well,
not a good car, but quite a likable car.
Okay.
Anyway, right. Sorry. I was back to my. Yes, I was extemporising.
Well,
the NSX,
you were saying that Ferrari had a fairly ropey lineup of cars at that time.
The most ropey lineup of cars that they have ever had. I can remember doing a group test with an NSX, a 911 Turbo, and a Spree, and a 348. And the NSX won, and the Ferrari came last. And that, to me, was that was kind of a bit of a red letter day. That was just like, oh my goodness! And you could just see how complacent Ferrari had come, how they'd been, you know, how long they'd rested on their laurels and just thought, well, that's good enough because we're Ferrari. Then the NSX turns up with that incredible V6 engine and that amazing gearbox. And it was light. It was all aluminium. It had all aluminium suspension. It was, you know, it was. They built a factory to build it. It was just beautiful. And you could just see the guys in Maranello looking at that thing, going, "Actually, maybe it's not okay to build cars like this anymore." And you know, in a heartbeat, it seemed the 348 had been turned into the 355, and suddenly, okay, that's how good this car could have been, because the 355 is a facelifted 348, and there has never in the history of the car been a more successful facelift than that. And that's Ferrari actually going, oh, okay, we better stop mucking about now. And then suddenly they come up with the 456, and you know, and the Testarossa becomes a 512 TR, These things are, are not coincidences that all this stuff happened straight after the NSX came out. Ferrari would never ever say that the NSX was the biggest boot up the arse that we've ever had. But that is how I have always read it. And if you look at the chronology where Ferrari was before and after the NSX, and that set Ferrari on a direct course to where they are today. Which is why I say, when you drive a Ferrari today and you think, my God, this is a good car, a tiny bit of that, if you link it right back, I'm sure it would have happened anyway. But the catalyst for the conversion of Ferrari, I believe, was the NSX.
Oh, that's interesting. Sorry. It's a hell of a legacy, isn't it?
I've prattled on a bit too long about that. But this stuff matters. It matters to me because, you know, I was around at the time, and I can just remember the sort of, all those sharp intakes of breath. When it first turned up, because, I think some people had driven it in Japan. We certainly hadn't. It seemed to me to be a lot of hot air spoken about this car. We were the impartial arbiters, all these things, and we'd really see this car for what it was. And it came in, and we just thought, oh, no, it really is that good.
That good.
It really is that good.
That's great. So we'll come back to the NSX. I just want to talk a bit more about the MX-5, because basically the principles that underpin that car are just right for a little roadster. They've just always been right. And I remember speaking to a Japanese MX-5 engineer during the launch of the fourth generation model, so the current one. This must have been 2016, I think. And he was explaining that his favourite version of that new car was the basic one with the smaller engine, tiny diddy little anti-roll bars, and no LSD. And he was saying that it's because when you go around a corner, you put your foot down, and as you're exiting, if you've applied too much throttle, you feel the inside rear wheel just spin, just go, and the car won't slide or anything. You'll just feel that go, just brake traction. And then he said that he loves that instant feedback, that moment of rotation of the tire, and you know straight away that your driving was wrong. And he said that that's the buzz that he gets out of driving. And I thought, okay, actually, that's not how I enjoy driving. But I just sort of reflect on that now, and I think, I don't think you'd ever hear that from a European car engineer or from an American car engineer. I think that is a sort of uniquely Japanese perspective about delicacy and poise and...
Yeah, I mean, it's a slightly... And I think this is a very, I think this shows how, the Japanese honour, I mean, particularly Lotus in particular. That has been a sort of slightly Lotus perspective, hasn't it? I mean, I've never heard anyone at Lotus express it in terms of what you're talking about the wheels spinning up. But, there is a good argument to say that a low powered car, a limited slip differential actually, causes more problems than it solves. Because if you haven't got the power to go, sliding it about on the power.
Yeah, what's it for?
And actually, all it really serves to do is make the car understeer a bit more and upset the balance of the car. But it's great that they are sitting there thinking about this stuff, isn't it?
Well, so what I think is that you and I often talk about, on this podcast, we talk about cars that are fun to drive at sensible road speeds and how that seems to be getting eroded more and more. But I don't know, perhaps it's, I mean, there are others, of course, but maybe it'll be the Japanese car industry that understands that more than any other and that celebrates the kind of car that you can drive enthusiastically on the road without taking huge liberties.
Yeah. And I think that, at this massive crossroads, at the time of quite clearly the most significant change in the motor industry, I probably think that there's ever been, certainly within my lifetime, I think that there will be opportunities for really, really clever, intelligent engineering solutions. I don't know what they are. If I was going to back anybody to come up with them, I'd back the Japanese because, we have seen them do it before.
They're so experimental, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. They'll have a crack at it. Just going back to the MX-5, I think if you wanted to just illustrate as clearly as possible just how good that car is, just how amazing it was then and remains today, just look at, you would think, wouldn't you, that if somebody came up with a really, really good concept for a car, and we've seen this happen, almost every time somebody comes up with a new kind of car or a kind of car that we haven't seen from, everybody else then piles in, all the car manufacturers think, right, we'll have a slice of that pie, in we go. They never did. You know, there was, you know, there was, you know, there was the Alpha Spider and the Fiat Barchetta and the, you know, and the last of the Toyota MR2s and all MGF. These sorts, and MGF, and they all sort of came along and they, you know, they had a bit of a sniff about and they had a look and then they went away again. You know, that is the car for 30 years. That car has had really no significant opposition, and that is as good a measure as you will find of just how good it is, because it's become. It's not just a sort of a sub-brand, which it is. It's become a class by itself, to which there are effectively no more points of entry, because it is just, you know, it's not a Lotus Elise because it's much more usable than that and it's much more affordable than that. And it's certainly not a Caterham, but nor is it, you know, an Audi TT. It is a proper driver's car that you can use every day. It's kind of like a sort of, you know, a really, really affordable 911, and you know, and the 911s have been enjoying the same sort of have the same sort of thing going for it for the last, you know, 60 years as well. So it's I think that is as good a measure as you'll find of just how good it is. Because usually, if a car is really, really good, it attracts a lot of opposition, all trying to, as I say, jump on the bandwagon. But when it's so good that the opposition goes, actually, no, we'll just leave it because we can't do, you know, all we're going to do is come across as being, you know, poor pretenders. Then, you know, I think that's the proper measure of the car.
Yeah, yeah, you're right, and. The MX-5 is such an interesting one. I think it's one of very, very few Japanese performance cars that sort of transcended car people. I think there are plenty of MX-5 drivers who are not petrol heads, who are not car lovers. They just like a convertible, sporty little car.
Yeah,
And
that works.
That works and is affordable. And I think the point that I was going to make is that for the most part, MX-5 aside, Japanese cars are really car lovers cars,
yeah.
Right, if you don't normally buy a Japanese performance car for status or to show off wealth or to whatever else, if you drive an Evo, if you drive an Impreza or a Civic Type R or something like that, you do so because you love driving.
Yes, and actually when they try to sell cars, you know, at the sort of elevated price that you need to get into that sort of prestige premium, you know, they tend not, you know, the NSX, which we've been, you know, waxing lyrical about, it didn't do very well at all. I don't think the new one's doing very well at all. And you know, I think largely, certainly in Europe, it's because we're a bunch of badge snobs. And you know, there will be people who would buy, you know, an Audi TT who wouldn't look at, you know, a Japanese, we wouldn't look at a GT86.
BRZ, yeah.
Or a BRZ, because, you know, it's better to drive, so what? That's something they don't require. But you'd have to explain to your neighbour why you turned up in a Toyota or a Subaru instead of an Audi. And it's terrible, but, you know, it's true, I believe it's true, and it cuts out such a large constituency of your potential customer base. Because what you're saying is actually, we're only going to appeal to, I was about to say proper people, which is a terrible thing to say. I don't mean that. What I mean is just proper enthusiasts, people who really get driving. And you are completely right. There is no other reason to buy, you know, people who used to buy, you know, the old, you know, Civic Type, you know, the original Civic Type R's, and, you know, up until, what was it, a couple of generations ago, you know, they had double wishbone suspension at every corner. You know, everybody else has struts at the front and a beam at the back. And Honda go, no, we're going to have double wishbones on ours. And we're going to have an engine which goes to 8,500 revs. And, you know, and you're not going to care about that, you know, when you can buy an Audi A3 or a 1 Series or even a Golf GTI. Because they have status. They say something about you. And if that thing isn't, I just really get cars and I just love driving, then you're not going to have one.
They certainly have a sort of boy racer image, don't they?
Definitely.
Dare I say it, a slightly chavvy image.
Yeah.
That a lot of people will find off-putting. A lot of people will. But if you're really into the subject matter, you see beyond that and you see the virtues of this machine and you just think, wow, that's a hell of a lot of fun to drive. I'd love one.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on a little bit. K cars. Have you ever driven a K car? You must have been in a few.
Yeah.
Although I do wonder if you fit.
Thank you very much. None taken. Yes, I do.
Purely height.
Yes. Yeah, I've driven. What have I driven? I can't remember. Although I've driven a Figaro. I've driven a Cappuccino. Okay. Yeah, I look ridiculous in them because I'm 6'3". But again, I know that they were We ought to have had Jo on there, shouldn't we? We ought to have had Jo, our engineer, because she's got a cappuccino and she loves all this stuff. So sorry, Jo, but you really should have been on this podcast and you could have explained the culture far better than either.
I think we need to get her to write something about K cars and in defense of the K car and why they're brilliant, because they are interesting little machines.
They are, and what interests me, I guess, most about them is they're not machines that people just thought, oh, here's a cool kind of car, let's do one of these. They are cars which only came about because of a set of regulations. You know, they came about for the most tedious of reasons. You know, the authorities said, you know, if you want to have this kind, I can't remember what it is, it's a tax break or something, you know, that your car can't be more than a certain length and, you know, have a certain engine size, because they wanted, I think what they wanted was really small, boring cars. And the Japanese, in their own inimitable way, thought, okay, that sounds like a challenge. Let's see how much fun we can have with this. And they just came up with these ridiculous cars, which I just found them charming. Really, really charming, lovely things. I haven't driven one for a long, long time. But, I mean, what's not to like?
I'd like to have a go.
They're high, they've got great technology in them. They're different. They look cool. You know, compared to any number of, you know, tedious, dull, you know, hatchbacks and stuff. Cool.
Little 660cc engines, weren't they? With turbos. And actually, you look at them and, okay, they're tiny, they're light, they've got small engines. Those principles are actually more relevant now than when the K car regulations came in, particularly if you're in the city. We should all be driving, if you live in a city, smaller cars that take up less room, that emit less.
Yes, I mean, absolutely.
It's just, they continue to be relevant even now, don't they? So the Japanese car industry produces hot hatches by the bucket load and little sports coupes and roadsters and bigger sports cars and four-wheel drive rally replicas, maybe not so much now as it used to, and big, powerful, thumping coupes like the GTR. But there have only been a small number of supercars, and we've mentioned the NSX, and there is, of course, the current one. There's the LFA. Right, okay,
sorry.
We'll come back to that. That response says a lot, doesn't it? So very, very few sort of six-figure supercars. And I wonder why that is. I suppose it's because mostly the brands are mainstream and they have their sort of upmarket offshoots, don't they?
But yeah, I think it comes back down to what I was saying about snob value. I just think those cars are really, really difficult to sell. And I think that, you know, Honda have shown, I think, over both cars that, you know, you can make, okay, I'm not a fan of the current NSX. It's just, I mean, you know, I think the current NSX shows that you can take that principle and you can just run too far with it. It is so overladen with engineering and technology. It's done the one thing that an NSX should never do, and it's just got too heavy. I think it's like a sort of 1750 kilo car, isn't it? It weighs a thick end of half a ton more than the old NSX. And I don't care that it's got four electric motors and it's four-wheel drive and it's got 800 gears or whatever. You know, I just care about what it's like to drive. But fundamentally, I'm afraid, even if that car had been as good today as the old one was 30 years ago, I genuinely think they would still have struggled to sell it. Because, you know... Again, it's exactly what I was talking about. You got to turn up in a Honda when your mates drive Porsches and Ferraris. And it's really, really sad that that is a decision-making process, but it undoubtedly is. And that you might forgo all that engineering excellence because you just care more about the badge on the front of it. And actually have a worse car, which you could well do. I'm not saying that specifically about the current NSX, obviously, but, you know, in the past and possibly again in the future, you could, you know, people will be choosing a car that is not as good for them just because they're a bit iffy about the badge on the, you know, on the nose of the alternative. Shame.
It is a pity, yeah. It is a pity, and that probably explains why the Japanese industry has produced so few of those very high-end cars. Although, okay, let's just do a couple of minutes on the LFA, because I've never driven one. The closest I've come was chasing Jethro Bovingdon through North Wales in one. He was driving the LFA. I was in something, I can't remember, but it was fast enough to keep up. And all I remember
remember. It's fast enough to keep up with LFA and you can't remember what it is.
I can't remember what it was. Maybe because it doesn't matter what I was driving, because I was chasing an LFA. And
could
when
you
that
hear
thing
it?
Accelerates, yeah, the sound, it's unbelievable. That V10, it was a Yamaha V10, wasn't it?
And it was a Yamaha V10, yeah.
Just sublime.
I just get all giddy when I think about the LFA. I know the car was hideously late. I know that they lost a packet on every single one of them. I mean, it was a crazy project, really. But it was one of, and I think it is, it remains one of the very, very finest road cars I've ever driven. When they did the Nürburgring edition, I mean, talk about total insanity. When they did the Nürburgring edition, they invited a small number of journalists to, funnily enough, the Nürburgring. And we were waiting around for the usual briefings, all the form fillings, all the disclaimers, and then we were expected to be told, okay, fine, so here's the instructor that's going to sit in your car, or here's the really slow car you're going to have to follow. And we were just waiting around. And eventually I went up and said to someone, and said, well, what's the form? And they went, well, there's the car, there's the track, off you go. I mean, it was just, they just put us in LFAs and they gave us the Nordschleifer. This wasn't the, you know, the little modern thing, which they'd hired exclusively, and just said, go and fill your boots. And if you wanted to, and if you wanted to follow something, they had some GT3 spec N24 something or other there, which was the only other car they had which wasn't an LFA, which was quick enough to go fast enough so that you could follow it meaningfully in an LFA. And I don't think many of us did. I think we just went and spent a day just arsing around on the Nordschleifer in LFA. I just can't believe we did that. There was no piece of paper that we signed. No one wagged a finger at us and said, you know, no one even said, just be a bit careful, or, you know, would you mind bringing it back? We just went off and just behaved like idiots for a day in these cars. And, you know, I certainly wasn't aware of, I don't know how long they ran the program for. It might have only been a one-day program, I can't remember. But, you know, certainly on the day I was there, they all came back. And we just had, you know, I can just remember going down the straight and just hearing this engine going, wah! And just watching the speed build and burn that handle so well. And it was such an intimate and involving and just brilliant experience. With possibly the best engine that's ever gone on a road car. I might take some convincing that there's ever been a better road car engine than that.
Wow, big call. Okay, but tell me about the gearbox.
I mean, in that environment, fine. You know, if you're going to go out and poodle around the world, around the roads. I mean, and also, I think it is the kind of car that you do make a few allowances for. The gearbox wasn't great, and yes, I'm sure if you went and drove it through heavy traffic in central London, it would bug the hell out of you. But it was only, you know, it was just like, it's almost like driving a vintage car without any synchromesh. You know, with all those, if you could drive those sorts of cars, it's just all about timing it correctly and understanding the pauses and where the ratios are and what you have to do between each gear. And as long as you did that, and in the LFA it would be about 8,000 times easier than it would be in, I don't know, a vintage Bentley or something. You just wait a little bit, then you could drive. You mean you could drive the LFA in a way that your passenger would think it was a double clutch car. But that would be because you were focusing on it. So it wasn't ideal. But in a car like that, which is an ultimate recreation, which is likely only ever to be driven in the right sorts of environments, it wasn't great. But, you know, what robotized manual gearbox ever was, frankly?
Mm. Yeah, not enough to sort of ruin the experience, clearly.
Not even close. No.
Yeah. Well, we know somebody who had an LFA, don't we? Hello, he'll be listening.
yes, we do. You sold an LFA.
Yeah, you'll never be forgiven for that. Okay, well, we need to wrap this up. We've done basically 40 minutes, call it half an hour on Japanese performance cars, and we've not once mentioned the GR Yaris. Should we leave it that way?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think the reason we haven't mentioned it is it's so new and because it has just been everywhere of late, hasn't it? But
it's,
I mean,
everywhere.
I think all I would say about it is it just shows, you know, the light still burns.
That's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Can I tell one more story? In the early 90s, I went to Japan to drive what would have been an NSX-R. And that was fun, at the Tochigi test track. And once we'd done all our mucking about in that, they said, oh, we've got something special to show you. And we went, oh, all right. And so we all sat down. And then out of nowhere, this unbelievable noise. And a brand new Formula One car just turned up, just in carbon fiber, no paint on it at all. And it went and did a few demonstration laps. And I was thinking, well, hang on a second. This is a state-of-the-art, completely compliant with whatever the current regs was, Formula One car. But Honda aren't in Formula One. So what's this about? Are you about to renounce your return to Formula One? And they went, no, it's just a sort of weekend project for the boys because they just really like that sort of stuff. And they had recently pulled out and they were a bit sad about that. So they thought, well, the top brass one day decide to go back in and go, we just want to sort of, know that we're still, on the case and on the money, so we thought we'd do this. And they just had a Formula One car there.
Wow. That's incredible.
And, I mean, it was just wonderful. And it just, the passion and the enthusiasm and the love and the dedication, it just said it all. They'd just done a pet Formula One car on the side because they could.
Because they could. There you go. And that's where we should leave, actually, because the enthusiasm for cars and driving is as real there as anywhere else in the world. And I think that's undeniable. Good. Oh, I quite fancy going to drive a Japanese performance car now. I don't know which one.
Can I recommend the LFA? There is one. Toyota do have one.
Yeah.
I don't think they lend it out very often. So I think you should make it your mission to think of a reason good enough to get them to lend it to you.
Well, I've never driven one. That'll do, won't it?
There you go.
I'll put a call in and see what happens.
If anybody from Lexus is listening to this, and it's not impossible. If you can think of any reason which might work, we'd be interested to hear. And in the meantime, we'll have some ideas.
Absolutely, we will. Good stuff. Okay, let's leave that one there. Please remember to rate and review the podcast. But mostly, if you're going to do anything for us, just go download the app and sign up. You'll enjoy it, I promise. Come back next week. We're slightly late this week, aren't we, because of the bank holiday. But on Monday evening next week, there'll be another podcast up. So we'll talk to you then.
Look forward to it. Thanks.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.